This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is Jack Horan. Jack is a partner at McKenna Long and Aldridge LLP here in Washington, D.C., focuses on government contracts, Civil False Claims Act litigation. And today on the show, Jack, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Roger. Thank you.
I'm looking forward to this conversation. It's one of a government contractor's favorite topics. not be a bearer of bad news, but Jack's going to talk about the Civil False Claims Act and how a contractor can stay out of the news or what they need to know.
Yes, so I hope it doesn't ruin the audience's day, Roger.
Well, it should not. It should help them plan.
Yes.
For better days, right?
Right.
Kind of thing. Yeah. So, Jack, Civil False Claims Act. Why, in particular, one of the things you focus on is multiple award schedules, GSA's program, and I guess the first question, why is that such a fertile area for, a fertile area, maybe that's not the right word, but we could look at it that way for Civil False Claims Act type litigation or relator counsel and all that kind of stuff.
I think it is a fertile area, Roger, and it was ignored for years, but it's become a focus of QTAM Relators Council and the government. And the reason I think it's become a focus and is a fertile area is it's, as you know, oftentimes the intersection between commercial business and government contracts. It's where the commercial contractor enters the government market. And as a result of that, you often see even very, very sophisticated companies in the commercial market enter the government market without the infrastructure that you often see of government contractors. They often view the government market as an arm of the commercial market, not recognizing there are significant differences. You have a situation where the rules, if you're not familiar with them, are counterintuitive. I can't tell you how many times I talked to a client who tells me that can't be the rule, that can't be the way the business is conducted.
They forget that they're dealing with the government. That's
exactly right, Roger.
A counterintuitive, of course.
That's right. But it is. I mean, you spend years and years in the commercial world, and then something you know very well, you tell them before you negotiate with the government, you have to disclose all your lowest prices, all your commercial sales practices, and it's very counterintuitive. And then you also have, I think, a lack of discipline in pricing in the commercial world, and that leads to problems with complying with the price reduction clause. So,
Jack, just on that lack of discipline, I think what that really is, it's discipline is forced by the market, right? And people price to win. And so when you talk about pricing practices and policies, isn't the ultimate policy like I price to win the project in the private sector?
And
regardless of what I'm doing other places, right?
Yes, that's exactly right. And
which is why it's counterintuitive.
And you have the other issue I see that's very similar to that is when you're entering into the GSA and VA schedule, you're not, particularly for the first time, you're not assured of any sales. So you have a commercial company that's entering into this market, and essentially the government's asking them for their best pricing or close to their best pricing without any of the guarantees. And they're not familiar with that concept, very concerned about doing that. And they view it as almost a government, and I think accurately so, the VA and GSA will disagree with me on this, but as a government list price, and they're willing to, oftentimes negotiate lower prices based on the order. But as the VA and GSA do not view it that way.
Right, which I keep saying all the time. I mean, it's, you know, it's not counterintuitive to say, you know, you get a better price for me when I know there's an economic incentive for me to give you a lower price. But just to get on the GSA schedules and then have to be, and, you know, and then essentially have to compete for orders at a second level consistent with statute and regulation, it's, yeah, there is a disconnect there.
There is. And I see the disconnect particularly during renewals of the contract or even the option period of the contract, because there you have GSA and VA with a history of sales. And oftentimes the position of GSA and VA in that circumstance is that they're going to look at the aggregate government sales as almost one order and look for pricing based on that. And that's another issue that I think contractors deal with. They view it as a market with different orders.
Multiple transactions,
yes. But back to the False Claims Act, you have a situation where you have a commercial company set up very well, very sophisticated, can do business incredibly well, in a new market that they're not familiar with. And beyond, we're really just talking about the pricing issues. Beyond that, you have other issues, as we're both aware, that they're not familiar with, like Trade Agreements Act compliance. You know, commercial companies really typically don't care where their product is sourced for the commercial marketplace. They're looking to satisfy commercial customers on price. They're just not familiar with those type of practices as well.
And is services another area?
Services is another area where it's somewhat counterintuitive, I think. As you know, in GSA in particular, services contracts are set up to fit into the GSA structure, where you provide a rate based on some level of expertise. The government usually likes to lock in the level of expertise. And then you have the services company providing the services, and they'll often see that they can fill the services with someone who they originally didn't contemplate. Sometimes I've even seen where the government requests a particular individual at a different expertise level or with a different background. And you have the situation there where the government sometimes retrospectively is concerned that you've delivered services with someone who doesn't have the expertise that the government contemplated at the beginning of the contract.
So you've overbilled, even though the service probably actually met the government's needs, right?
That's right. And sometimes, as I've said, the services not only met the government's needs, but filled a particular need that no one contemplated. And you met the government's need based on a specific request by the contracting officer for a particular person or a particular expertise.
You know, Jack, just big picture, are there more of these cases now? Are they going away? Are there more of them?
Yeah, they're not going away, Roger. They started a little bit later than the typical government contract cases. We've progressed into GSA and VA contracts, but they're obviously here to stay. And some of the recent cases over recent years have been wildly successful. You have a settlement with the NetApps, which was in April 2009 at $128 million. You have a settlement with very major companies well above the multi-million dollar levels. Just to list a few, Oracle, which I think at the time and maybe still is, was the highest GSA settlement, was at $199.5 million. Sun at $46 million. Cisco, Westcon at $48 million, HP at $55 million, and all of those were within the last 2 to 3 years. So nothing breeds activity like success, I think, and key TAM relators in the government have been very successful in this area.
Well, what's, you know, for a key TAM relator, what is the, I guess, can you sort of explain the economic incentive?
Sure.
Sure.
It's a somewhat unusual statute that arose back in the Civil War days when I forget some of the originating cases, but one I think I remember is someone billed the government for horses that they didn't deliver. But it's a statute that allows anyone to file a case on behalf of the government against a government contractor alleging fraud. And the person who files the case on behalf of the government is called a QI-TAM relator. The QI-TAM relator has the incentive to file the case because they receive a portion of the ultimate settlement or recovery from the government. And, you know, that can be in the 15% range depending on their participation. So you have QI-TAM relators and, you know, settlements of $200 million, perhaps getting 20, 30, even more recovery on that. The other reason they're very popular and are going to continue is the relator's counsel is entitled to its attorney's fees in False Claims Act case. So you have...
So they get the money in, they get their attorneys paid for it.
They get their attorneys paid for. And that's an incentive for attorneys, and there's a very active bar out there for QI-TAM relators. And just as an aside, Roger, that when you represent the contractor, that's one of the more frustrating aspects of the case, because you realize as you're fighting the good fight for the contractor, you may very well be driving up the attorney's fees for the
sure,
other side.
Sure. Well, Jack, right now we do have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll be talking more to Jack Horan. Jack is a partner at McKenna Long & Aldrich, LLP, and we'll talk a little bit more about some of the specific issues with regard to schedules and some ongoing cases as well, or recent decisions. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we are talking to Jack Horan. Jack is a partner at McKenna Long & Aldrich, LLP, and Jack focuses on government contracts, Civil False Claims Act litigation, and also helps clients or advises clients with regard to GSA schedule contracts and contracting in general. Jack, you know, when we were talking about earlier, you know, the GSA schedules in the last segment, and the cases aren't going away, and talked a little bit about one of the issues in particular. But I'd like to services, TAA, and price reduction clause. I'd like to dive a little bit deeper into those and get your take on what those requirements are and why they do create fertile ground for Civil False Claims Act type litigation. So first, let's just go down through them one at a time and talk about them. The first one is the favorite one, the price reduction clause. What is that?
The price reduction clause is even difficult to articulate for me, but essentially it's a clause in all GSA and VA contracts that is intended to assure that the government continues to get a favorable price. The way it's structured is during negotiations, the contractor and the government agree on a basis of award customer. That and the reason it's called a basis of award customer is it's the customer that the government and the contractor base the VA or GSA pricing on. Then during the entire period of the contract under the price reduction clause, any reduction to the price to that basis of award customer has to be flowed through to the government. And it can get complicated as to the formula of that, but essentially the principle is the government benefits from any discounts or other concessions to the basis of award customer. There's other aspects of it as well, too. If you reduce your price list, that requires a reduction to the government. And if you reduce or change the basis upon which the price was negotiated, primarily your commercial sales practices, that can also result in a required price reduction to the government. So the bottom line is the government pegs its pricing to a commercial customer or customers, and then if you reduce that price, you have to give it to the government.
So, and is this the area where there most of the cases arise?
It is. It's there's a cousin or a brother or a sister to the price reduction clause, which is the commercial sales practices. But yes, the combination of those two, and they almost always interplay, is the area where most of these cases arise. And the problem with the price reduction clause, Roger, that there's many problems in my view, and I could spend hours talking about my concerns about that. But one of the problems for compliance or administration of the price reduction clause is oftentimes the VA or GSA identify a very broad basis of award customer. And if a contractor isn't familiar with the process, they'll agree to that. Many, many times I see all commercial customers as the basis of award customer. Short of that, you see national accounts or very large categories. And the result of that, for example, the all commercial customers, is that means if there's a price reduction to any commercial customer out there, it very likely means you need to reduce the price to the government. And that's companies who have that type of BOA really have trouble administering the price reduction clause.
And those companies, well, it goes back to, you know, when we talked in the first segment, right? The pricing or the people are organized to price to win in the marketplace, right? So, and it's based on a requirement. Typically, right? It's not like the GSA schedules, which is like a promise to be able to compete for future work.
Correct.
Right. So it seems to me the price reduction clause in a larger sense is anti-competitive. The example is the one you just, for example, if it's all commercial customers, every time I want to go do business in the private sector, I've got to think about whether or not I can give a lower price and what's the impact to the government and whether, you know, I'm going to be able to compete for that government work. And right. So it's an additional calculation, both in terms of, you know, what it means for my federal market and also what it means in terms of potential liability. Every time I want to price something to win in the private sector, that just makes no competitive sense to me.
That's correct. I think many people in industry view it that way. Most definitely, if you're going to make a competitive move with regard to anyone within the basis of award customer category, you have to consider the effect on the government business. And the likely effect is for the period that you're offering or providing those prices to the commercial customer, you're going to have to provide that to every government customer, regardless of the size of the sale, regardless of the other competitive circumstances for the government customer. And you mentioned one point that is, I think, probably the most significant, and that's the size of the order. But there are other competitive pressures out there that I find VA and GSA readily ignore. For example, you have a customer, a contractor trying to break into a new market. So right. They offer especially competitive pricing there with the thought they're in the market and then they can, you know, continue in the market and adjust their prices going forward.
It's sales goals, right?
Yep.
To enter and like looking forward to where they want to be in that market.
That's right. That's exactly right. And, you know, within the commercial market, they have the flexibility to, you know, either regionally or with a particularly large customer, make that effort to offer very competitive pricing for an overall strategic goal, but not have it affect all of their commercial prices. That's not true with the price reduction clause under the government, for the government market, because if it's within the basis of award customer, they've basically signed on to offer that pricing to the government. Another thing troubling about it is in a recent case with a large IT company, the government actually made the argument that the IT company's effort to manage the price reduction clause was an attempt to avoid the price reduction clause and to avoid giving the government the prices.
So wait a second. You try to comply with the clause and you are violating the clause.
Right? Yep. It's
counterintuitive there. Or is it Kafkaesque? I don't know. Right.
It's all in your definition of complying, though. This company, according to the government, I'm not familiar with the actual practices or the accuracy of these allegations, but one of the government's allegations was the company tried to invite its commercial customers to provide bigger sales so that they would get over the sales level, I think, would get over the maximum order threshold, which would allow them pricing flexibility with the commercial customer because that's one of the exceptions to the price reduction clause. And the government alleged that...
So wait a second. So what you're saying is the government argued that the company was trying to sell more to its customers.
Yeah, well, that's right. That was the effect of it. But by trying to sell more, the government argued that they were attempting to avoid the price reduction clause and avoid the reduction of price to the government. And I think, as you know, and at least my experience, is one of the ways in which you comply with the price reduction clause is price discipline in the commercial market. So you don't trigger a price reduction to the government unknowingly. And at least based on this most recent argument by, or fairly recent argument by the government, DOJ, that mere practice of trying to comply, depending on how you exercise it, could be an attempt to avoid the price reduction clause. And I find that terribly troubling.
Well, yeah. You use the word price discipline, I almost use the word price controls.
Yes.
In a certain sense, because it fundamentally restricts a commercial firm's ability to operate in the commercial marketplace. With these companies, right, what do? They set up separate divisions, or they do things to try to insulate themselves?
Yeah, I mean, they sometimes try to set up separate divisions. There's some utility in that. There's some argument if it's a separate division, that doesn't matter. It's mm-hmm. still within the company's pricing practices. The most common effort that I see is, and this is a good practice, hopefully the government won't decide this is an attempt to avoid it, the price reduction clause, but you negotiate a fair but limited basis of award customer,
right.
And then you discipline your price with regard to that basis of award customer. So for that commercial customer, you are careful not to offer additional price reductions that could flow through to the government. And again, what's problematic about that, it's the entire government and the entire period of the price reduction to the commercial customer.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, it's a counterintuitive approach to pricing.
And if you add to that, Roger, the fact that you have a commercial company that oftentimes hasn't designated a particular individual or a particular group of individual with knowledge of these counterintuitive requirements to administer the contract, and you have a recipe for disaster from my perspective, or a recipe for a great False Claims Act case from the Keaton Bar's perspective.
Right. So, hey, Jack, right now we do have to take another break.
Sure.
But when we come back, we'll talk. We'll move on to the Trade Agreements Act and talk a little bit more about services, and then move into some recent cases. But right now we do have to take a break. My guest today is Jack Horan, partner at McKenna Long & Aldridge, LLP, and you're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today we're talking to Jack Horan. Jack is a partner at McKenna Long & Aldridge, LLP. And Jack, we were talking about like the three, I guess, the trifecta. Let's get the right word there. The trifecta of big ticket issues that involve contract compliance under the Schedules Program and potential Civil False Claims Act liability. First was the price reduction clause, Trade Agreements Act, and then the services arena. And I know there's one area you want to talk a little bit more in, the pricing area, and that's the commercial sales practices format and the submissions era.
That's right, Roger. As I mentioned, it's a close relative of the price reduction clause, and the way in which GSA and VA sets its pricing with contractors and establishes its basis of award customer or BOA customer is it begins with a solicitation that requires the offeror to disclose its commercial sales practices to the VA and GSA. And the most important element of that, it's complicated. In fact, so complicated that the GSAIG in a report to Congress estimated that well over 50% of contractors get it wrong based on their audits. But the primary, one of the primary elements of that is a contractor has to tell the GSA or VA the prices, discounts, and concessions for either its most favored customer, if it's offering the GSA and VA pricing equal to or better than that most favored customer, or if it's offering the GSA or VA pricing that's less favorable than the most favored customer, any commercial customer that gets more favorable pricing. And as I mentioned earlier, that is incredibly counterintuitive to a commercial company, because essentially what you're telling them is, before I negotiate with this other party, I have to tell them everything that you would normally not disclose in a negotiation. It's also particularly difficult because it's regardless of terms and conditions. So once I get past the first obstacle of telling a client who's embarking on a GSA schedule that you have to provide the government with your history of better commercial pricing, the second obstacle is getting them to understand that it's regardless of terms and conditions. So it doesn't matter how big the purchase was. It doesn't matter what else the customer may have agreed to do for you, perhaps make you an exclusive provider. Customers, the reason I wanted to mention that is contractors oftentimes get that wrong because of the counterintuitive nature of it, the difficulty of making the disclosures, particularly for a complex commercial sales practices, practices that companies may have. And that is a baseline by which the government then reviews its pricing for the whole 10-year history of the GSA or VA contract. Any deficiency in that disclosure, there's a contract clause, basically can result in a reduction of the price that you sold to all government customers during the entire period of the contract, which is bad enough, but it's also the basis for False Claims Act case. The government alleges that it was oftentimes recklessly not disclosed, and as a result of that, that is a fraudulent pricing disclosure.
Right, and it's just on the mechanics of it. That would be each invoice that's submitted. How does that work? Just real quick.
Yeah, each invoice. It's $11,000 penalty in addition to triple the difference in price. So you could have 10 years of $11,000 per invoice and liability and 10 years of triple whatever the price difference was.
That's
it creates a lack of sleep for me and clients sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I can say nightmares, bad dreams. So let's move on to the next area. That's the Trade Agreements Act.
Trade Agreements Act. Yes, that's another area that has become hot in GSA in particular, but also VA contracts. It started around 2005 when a competitor to some of the major office supply companies filed a QTAM suit alleging that the office supply companies were supplying products that weren't manufactured in the right countries. And where it originates is there's a clause in GSA and VA contracts that requires a contractor to deliver only products from certain countries that are designated because they have trade agreements with the United States. One of those, there's a number of companies on a list, but one of the companies that's not on the list that creates
countries.
Lots of
countries.
What I was saying, companies. There are a number of countries that are on the list, designated countries, but one of the countries that's not on the list that's created a lot of headaches is China because of the move to outsource manufacturing to China.
Right. So, what happens is somebody delivers something made in China, theoretically.
Yes.
And it meets the government's needs, actually, typically, probably. These cases usually aren't about a defective product. It's defective in the sense that it doesn't meet country of origin requirements, but as to its actual function, right, it doesn't. Typically, that's not the issue.
That's right. It's never been the issue in these cases that I'm aware of. The allegation is entirely that the contractor was supposed to provide a product from designated countries, but provided a product from a non-designated country. And oftentimes, there's not even an attempt by the government or the QTAM relator to look at the product and see how serviceable it is. In fact, in my experience, they try to avoid that issue altogether because the product is probably
just fine.
Yeah. And in fact, they're never returned. They're used for years. There's not an attempt to return them in these cases. There's simply the allegation that based on government policy, it was from the wrong country.
Yeah. So services, I know you touched on the first segment a little bit about that. Is it, do you have anything to add? That's really the issue of labor qualifications and whether the individuals who are performing work for certain labor categories, right, meet the qualifications that the company has identified?
Yes, that's it in a nutshell. For services contracts, which aren't a great fit, I think, for historical GSA contracts, the government establishes typically a per-hour price for different labor categories, and they require the contractor to define the qualifications of those labor categories. You oftentimes see things like a level of education, level of experience.
Yeah.
Contractor begins to perform, perhaps uses someone who isn't within the category that they bid, and the allegation is that that is a false claim.
Yeah, well, I want to go to close out the segment just talking about infrastructure and what, you know, just do you have recommendations? We've talked about all the list of horribles and the issues. Do you have specific recommendations, like a top three or five or whatever? I don't want to put pressure on you, Jack, but just like things that people need to think about if they're going to enter the federal marketplace.
Yes. And, yes. The first part is the top one is to somehow become acquainted with these very issues that we've identified. There's ways you can do that. You can use consultants. You can hire someone who's very experienced. You can join an association of contractors that can assist you. I know, Roger, you're with the Coalition for Government Procurement, and you all do a great job in letting the industry know what is required. And to anticipate that, these requirements in the preparation of the proposal so that you don't make the mistakes that some contractors have made and that I've identified. For example, agreeing to an especially broad basis of award customer that you can't comply with. That's number one. Number two is to have someone internally who's at least one person who's managing your GSA and VA contract, who's aware of the continuing obligations, so that you're not in a situation where years down the line you've realized that you haven't been complying with these continuing obligations. And then number three is very important and overlooked, and that is to have written policies that assure compliance. I can't tell you, Roger, how many times a company has come to me and said, you know, we're not really sure what's going on with this contract because our contract manager left a year ago. We don't really know what he was doing. We relied on him or her to comply with the contract, and we're just not sure what's happening there. So you have a history if you have written policies, and you also have, you're not relying on one individual.
Right. That's great advice, Jack. And Jack, we do have to take our last break now. But when we come back, we'll talk about some recent cases involving Civil False Claims Act, you know, what the recent trends are, and just close it out with, you know, the current landscape a little bit more. But you are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we're talking to Jack Horan. Jack is a partner at McKenna Long & Aldridge LLP. Jack focuses on government contracting, Civil False Claims Act litigation, GSA schedules, VA schedules, contract work. And Jack, this segment, let's just do a sort of recent developments, recent cases, what's going on in the world of Civil False Claims Act. And with that, this is easy for me. So Jack, what's going on?
Well, there's two areas in False Claims Act I and others track, I think, and they're particularly appropriate for GSA and VA contractors. And the first area is the implied certification area. And the second area is what's going on with damages. Implied certification, for the listeners out there, is essentially an argument that QTAM relators and the government has made and the courts have accepted, that by submitting a claim under a government contract, the contractor is implicitly certifying that it's compliant with not only the express terms of the voucher and the invoice, but all contractual, regulatory, and statutory requirements. So by submitting the claim, you're basically saying...
And claim, you mean it could be that's like the invoice to be paid or whatever, right?
Yes, sorry. That's right. I was using claim in the technical False Claims Act case. False Claims Act sense. But yes, the invoice. So by submitting an invoice, the contractor is saying, I'm compliant with everything, which creates tremendous headaches for contractors. It also creates headaches for the courts because even the courts recognize that that is a bit crazy because of how regulated the business is. So courts have come up that have accepted the implied certification argument, have come up with rationales to limit it. And one is that it's only a regulation or contract clause that is material to the government's decision to pay the invoice. The cases are developing in that area. It's fairly well settled as far as the circuits, but there's a split among the circuits as to whether applied certification is accepted at all, and then if it is accepted, as to how you limit it, if you're going to use the material to the decision to pay.
So what are examples of things that are, quote, material to the decision
Good
to
question.
Pay?
Good question.
If you, or is that an evolving question?
That is an evolving question, and that's really what's problematic for, I think, contractors, because DOJ and GSA and VA aren't going to say that in advance because they don't want to close the door on some other issue that could be material to pay, material to the decision to pay. So the only way you can really figure it out, I think, is have the courts tell you whether it's material to the decision to pay. And it comes out in different areas, different ways. You know, I think one case, if I'm remembering correctly, said that for healthcare reimbursement, the fact that under some regulations you need to have an emergency department in your hospital isn't material to the decision to pay, you know, under the healthcare programs. But the question is, you know, is posting an EEO poster material for the decision to pay? Is the compliance
right,
with
like
a...
you forget to put that poster up,
right?
Like whatever,
that's
right?
Right.
Or it gets ripped down somehow.
That's right. Or is compliance with a subcontracting plan material decision to pay? And what makes it particularly difficult is it's hard to identify. Some are easy. You know, I think a compliant product is material to the decision to pay. But the problem is getting a decision out of the court is also troublesome because that means a contractor has to litigate the case and go and endure the exposure of treble damages, $11,000 per invoice, paying someone like me a lot of money to defend, paying some the other side if they lose to sue them. So that area is evolving. There are cases that come up as to whether something is a material decision to pay. Material to the decision to pay, I guess the SAIC case decided that noncompliance with the organizational conflict of interest requirements was material to the decision to pay.
Right. That's a case where SAIC was alleged to have violated a contract clause dealing with or regulations dealing with organizational conflict
right.
of interest with regard to the service it was providing.
That's right. That's right. So that's an area that is constantly developing and interesting, particularly for GSA and VA contractors. Damages is another area. There's been a move, in my view, to expand the damages calculations. For example, in the TAA case, what we were just discussing, the question is, how do you determine damages there? I would be a proponent of certainly saying that damages are the difference in value between a product made in Mexico or China.
Right.
The government and QTAM relators usually take the position that it's not that simple because of the policy requirements of the Trade Agreements Act. Their typical position is that you double or triple the total value of the product and then give a credit back for the value of the product actually provided, which usually means that you're talking about double damages. At
right,
a minimum.
Yeah.
There's a case very recently where the very issue of what the value is where the government doesn't get a tangible benefit. That was Feldman v. Van Gorp, I'm sorry. And that was a grant case where a third party got the benefit of the government grant policy. And the government contended because of the the falsity or the that the that the contractor,
the grantee, right,
was not providing the services the government expected to the right category of grant recipients, that the government received no value. So the allegation there was that the entire value of the grant was the damages to the government. And again, when you're talking about a False Claims Act case, that means treble damages. And that also, that's very similar to a Longhi case, L-O-N-G-H-I case, that found similarly in a grant case. So the problem there, in my view, is not only the expansion of damages theory, but the application of that potentially to GSA and VA cases where you get things like the TAA where the benefit isn't tangible.
Sure. Yeah.
Another case, very recent, with a government defense contractor, the allegation was that the defense contractor intentionally underbid, lowered its bid on a cost contract case, and as a result of that, received the contract fraudulently. And the court there decided that the contractor argued that a bid is essentially an estimate, a proposal is an estimate, and that can't be the basis for a False Claims Act case. The court decided that under the right circumstances, that could be the basis for a False Claims Act case.
So, my God, yes. That's just like, that is crazy
it
stuff.
It is crazy. And the facts of that case, at least as indicated, was the during negotiations, the government told the contractor its bid looked high, so the contractor actually lowered the bid in response to negotiations. That's troubling, again, because of the expansion of the False Claims Act case, but also probably for services and time and material contracts
absolutely.
For GSA and VA. There's one final case, just to brighten the days of the contractors who are listening, that came. It's United States X-Rail Williams v. Renal Care Group. And that case is interesting to a lawyer because it discusses reckless disregard standard of the False Claims Act False Claims Act. And the court recognized that if you go to the government with your interpretation of a regulation, that's important in the decision as to whether you're recklessly disregarding the effect of the regulation, which was helpful. What's more important is, I won't get into the facts of the case, but the government was essentially alleging that the fact that the contractor was looking to increase its profit through the structure in which it was attempting to comply with the regulation was an indication of a False Claims Act intent. And the court, I'm glad to say, said that there's essentially nothing wrong with a company trying to maximize its profit as long as it's done within the regulations, that in itself is not a problem for the company.
Wow. That's it's interesting, the argument. I mean, I guess, market incentives can be basis for false claims in a certain sense.
Well, at least it could be, I wouldn't go quite that far, Roger, but at least it could be the basis for supporting that the contractor was intentionally not complying with regulations, that the profit motive of what drove them.
So one quick last thing I know, the Small Business Jobs Act of 2012,
yes.
I think?
Yes. And the reason I think that's important, Roger, is because of the push under GSA and VA schedule contracts to using small businesses. But essentially, the Small Business Job Act of 2012 essentially causes a statutory presumption or implements a statutory presumption that if a small business misrepresents its status as a small business, the damage to the government is the entire value of the contract. So we're back to the expansion of damages. Essentially, a small business may be looking at treble damages, triple the value of the contract based on that misrepresentation. The second thing it does in False Claims Act context is they statutorily deem a submission of a bid or proposal that's falsely certified as willful. So it statutorily supports the mens rea requirement.
Creates a presumption, right?
Creates a presumption and supports the mens rea requirement. So what you're going to be seeing there is small businesses. Oh, and finally, it statutorily makes it a policy of the government to basically root out small business fraud. So you're going to see an increased emphasis on small business fraud. And I think eventually it's going to spill over into large businesses under the small business subcontracting plans.
Right. Well, on that cheerful note, Jack.
Well, I was trying to end on a cheerful note.
Well, you know, that's just a hard area, right? But Jack, I want to thank you for being on the show today. Again, I want to thank my guest, Jack Horan, partner at McKenna Long & Aldridge, LLP. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30 only on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.